This is an ABC podcast.
This is Pacific Beach on ABC Radio Australia. Today, as the PNG Prime Minister puts the Australian government on notice about security contracts for Manus Island, the PNG government itself is coming under increased pressure to sell the luxury Maserati cars that it bought for millions of kina for APEC.
They led the public to believe that they were already buyers. They've been lined up to purchase the Maseratis at the end of the APEC. It's quite clear that those people are misled.
And are they a bunch of bad apples or have they been unfairly treated? 10 Samoan men have been blacklisted and sent packing from New Zealand over misdemeanours like taking drugs, stealing and having extramarital affairs while they've been there for a season of work.
We are married men in Samoa and I had to do the right thing to request the employer to send that person back to Samoa so he can sort his issues with his wife.
But with no official database on who exactly has been blacklisted, an expert says there's always the chance such workers could make it to Australia's seasonal workers scheme. We'll have more on that story later in the program. Good morning. I'm Catherine Growl. First, though, relations between the new government of Papua New Guinea and Australia are set to face their first test, with the new PNG Prime Minister James Marape sending a clear message to the Australian government. He wants it to immediately cancel the contract of the security firm Paladin for its work on Manus Island. The company's $423 million contract for work with refugees and non-refugees comes up at the end of this month. The awarding of that contract has been surrounded in controversy this year after media reports revealed that Paladin had been handed the contract through a closed tender. That process is now being investigated by Australia's Auditor General. We'll have more in a moment from our PNG correspondent Ashley Whiting on this story and also hear exactly what the Prime Minister James Marape had to say. But first, the Prime Minister was responding to a question put by the opposition MP, the Governor for Oro Province, Gary Juffer, in Parliament yesterday. Let's take a listen.
That company was awarded a $423 million contract under very strange circumstances and with absolutely no input whatsoever from PNG or PNG authorities, the PNG government, etc. It's about to be renewed. I would like to know, what is the PNG government's position in relation to this particular matter? Are we going to just sit by and let foreign governments come and dictate what they and their companies will do in this country? How are we going to handle this now that we have come up with the phrase of taking back PNG? How are we going to manage this particular situation? Especially when it is now being revealed in the Australian media that the awarding of this contract has some very strange circumstances whereby a foreign affairs employee in the Australian government is said to have manipulated or in some way or another influenced the awarding of this contract and is now working for this very company. Why can't the PNG Immigration Department be responsible for any such contracts?
That is the opposition PNG MPs, the Governor for Oro Province, Gary Juffer, demanding answers there in Parliament yesterday. Well, for more on this story, here is our PNG correspondent, Natalie Whiting.
This is the first sitting day of Parliament that we've seen since the new Prime Minister, James Marape, came to power. It's been a talking point, the issue of Paladin in the days leading up to it. We had the Immigration Minister say that he wanted to see this contract cancelled. And obviously, James Marape standing up in Parliament and making that point very clear to Australia.
I will, in this instance, through this response, ask the Australian head of mission here, Australian High Commission here, to furnish to us a report at the earliest. And we don't intend for foreign contractors to operate here in business like security. It's a business that local companies can be engaged in. And I ask the Australian government to stop this contract forthwith. I ask our Immigration Minister and the Foreign Affairs Minister to convey this at the earliest to Canberra that we will not tolerate foreign companies engaged in business like security that national companies can be engaged in. And this arrangement to be reviewed in its fullest. And that wherever this contract is heading to, it be terminated in as far as PNG government is concerned. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
The PNG government obviously says that there are companies here who can do the work. And certainly security is a very big industry across Papua New Guinea. However, we did see in 2017 the government look to take control of these services and then have to pull out. They were heading into caretaker mode ahead of an election. But it was them pulling out that Home Affairs says is the reason why Paladin got the contract without an open tender, because they say there was no time to run that. So, I mean, we have seen PNG make this move before. What will happen now? And if there is a company here in PNG that has the capacity to take on such a big contract remains to be seen. We've reached out to the Home Affairs Department. We haven't heard back yet. Obviously, we did hear not too long ago from the Minister, Peter Dutton, that there would likely be a contract extension for Paladin. Given there's only 5 days left before this contract ends, it would seem there would have to be some kind of an extension. But what discussions are had between Australia and PNG about the long-term future of this contract will be interesting. Obviously, there are work permits and things that are issued by the PNG government. So, I mean, they do have some element of control there. Paladin does also subcontract to some local companies that are on Manus. So there are quite a few locals working for the company. It is a majority local workforce. So it's going to be interesting to see how the PNG government handles these discussions and this potential transition period.
That is our PNG correspondent, Natalie Whiting. We're staying in PNG, where the government there is coming under increased pressure to sell the luxury purpose-built cars that it bought for millions of kina as it hosted last year's APEC summit. It's been revealed this week that only one of the 40 Maseratis that had been bought have been sold so far, with the minister responsible for APEC admitting the tender process to sell them had been mishandled. PNG's Trade Union Congress is now calling for a thorough investigation, and we're going to hear more on that in just a moment. But first, the team at our Pacific Mornings program headed to the streets of Port Moresby to find out how everyday people are perceiving this news. Let's take a listen.
From my point of view, yes, it's a waste of money, because after the APEC, those Maseratis generate zero kina to the economy of the nation.
The cars were supposed to be tendered after the APEC meeting, but apparently the cars were not sold.
Do you think it was a waste of money?
No, because we needed VIP cars to transport, to provide transport for the delegates who came here for the meeting.
Those are some differing views on the streets of Port Moresby there. Well, now, among those criticising the way the process has been handled is the head of PNG's Peak Union and also the country's Doctors Association, which says that the government got it very wrong with its spending priorities. Here is our reporter, Evan Wasuka, with the story.
When the purchase of 40 luxury Maseratis were publicised last year, there was no shortage of public criticism. In response, the government assured the public that the luxury vehicles would be sold on soon after the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Conference. That hasn't happened. Only one has been sold.
You'd have to be a really brave man or a fool to buy a Maserati.
John Pasca is the president of the PNG Trade Unions Congress. He says the concerns over the buying of the vehicles has been validated.
They led the public to believe that they were already buyers, that they had been lined up to purchase the Maseratis at the end of the APEC. It's quite clear that those people were misled.
Mr. Pasca says an investigation into the legitimacy of the purchase of vehicles is needed. He says the call by Police Minister Brian Kramer in recent weeks for a report on APEC to be tabled is a step in the right direction.
If it is taken to him, then I think from there on, I would imagine that it's appropriate also for the Ombudsman Commission to also call for the reports to be tabled before then, so that people can be, the trail of money that was used to during APEC can be traced, and a determination can be made as to whether they were done appropriately, whether there was a misappropriation involved.
Mr. Pasca says even if the Ombudsman doesn't investigate, a task force should be set up to look into the report. The minister responsible for APEC, Justin Chachenko, has told local media that the sale of their vehicles was stalled because of processes within the Ministry of Finance.
It has been mishandled by the Department of Finance in that the tenders were issued wrongly. That's the problem. Where there was no reserve price, so that means then the whole objective of recouping the funds that we have stated from day one was not achieved, and so we have to go through that process again.
But Mr. Pasca doesn't believe it's the fault of the ministry.
I find it rather amusing that you should be putting blame on the Minister for Finance. The fact of the matter is that you can't pass the buck. You were the Minister for APEC. At that point in time, you should have fast-tracked, or you should have put certain measures in place to ensure that due process was followed.
Dr. Naipaw is the president of the Doctors Association. He says the current situation puts into question the amount of money spent on APEC.
But the amount of money that was spent to entice the people of the world to come to the APEC meeting was big at a cost. And right now, as we speak, when back of the vehicle that sitting at a wharf of the whole is a reflective of how the planning was done.
At the end of the day, Mr. Pascha of the Trade Unions Congress says the majority of vehicles were not even used during APEC.
A good number of the vehicles were just parked permanently from day one right up until the end of APEC.
Dr. Naipaw says PNG's public could have been better served.
85% of the people, they live in the villages. So these are the people that needs to see those services, right? Basically, when you see what in the village, there's food, shelter, water, clothing, and everything is there. Right, what they need is the basic medicines, right, that can treat those infections.
It's Dr. James Naipaw. He's the president of PNG's Doctors Association. Evan Wasuka reporting.
Pacific Beat.
Bad behaviour by some of Samoa's seasonal workers is in the spotlight after a group was blacklisted, named and shamed publicly, and sent home from New Zealand for a range of offences, including taking drugs, stealing, and having extramarital affairs. The 10 men will have to face the sanction of their families, their neighbours, and their village council. But the Samoan government says the harsh punishment is necessary to protect the integrity of the seasonal workers scheme. In a moment, we're going to take a look at whether the punishment is justified and also hear from one expert who says that while the men may have been blacklisted from New Zealand, there's nothing necessarily in place to stop them from applying to work in Australia. But first, here is Bill Bainbridge with the story.
Samoa's Prime Minister Tuilepa Selele left little doubt about his view of seasonal workers who break the rules. In a statement, he publicly named and shamed the men and said the program would not be collateral damage due to the irresponsible actions of a handful of ungrateful Samoans. And he said the government would continue a zero-tolerance approach to undesirable behaviour. Samoa's Auckland-based Trade Commissioner Magali Maoli Magali says the 10 men sent home were made well aware of their obligations before they arrived in New Zealand.
The workers are made aware of that before they leave Samoa.
There are around 2,500 Samoans working in New Zealand and another 500 in Australia. The Trade Commissioner says the scheme is bigger than any one individual.
The scheme is really about government to government. It's not about people, it's not about employers to family. So the government has to step in and make sure that the scheme lasts and that a lot more people can be brought in.
New Zealand-based liaison officer Lemalunele Lelua is tasked with looking after the welfare of seasonal workers and stepping in to investigate when things go wrong. She says some were caught by their employer smoking marijuana on the job. Others were caught stealing or fighting, and then others were investigated after their wives back in Samoa complained about their husbands being unfaithful.
We are married men in Samoa, and I had to do the right thing to request the employer to send that person back to Samoa so he can sort his issues with his wife and then allow him to come back to work here.
Once home, the men are likely to face further sanction from their village council. And not only are they punished, their entire home village will also be blacklisted from the scheme until further notice. Lemalunele Lelua says the punishment is designed to send a signal to anyone involved in the seasonal worker scheme.
I think it sends a clear message to other RSE workers, and not only New Zealand but Australia, because we have had lots of problems in Australia right now, drink driving and other incidents. But I think it's from a government perspective that they are really taking a bold approach in this kind of incidents that may have an impact on the RSE program, so that when they come up here, they do behave. So I think that's why the Prime Minister wants to send out a clear message that any one of them that, you know, got their contract terminated, will be sent back home and will be dealt with by the village council.
Slimalu Nele Le Lua. She's a liaison officer in New Zealand for Samoa. The reporter there, Bill Bainbridge. Well, as we heard there in that story, the blacklisting by the Samoan government is intended to send a clear message to workers not just in New Zealand, but also those who are here in Australia on the seasonal worker program as well. So is it an effective and fair approach? And without an official database of who has been blacklisted, is there actually a way to prevent such people from switching between the two programs of both Australia and New Zealand? Rochelle Bailey is a labour migration expert at the Australian National University who has done extensive research on this very matter, and I spoke with her earlier. As we understand it, no one's actually had any criminal charges laid against them. Simply, they were caught by their supervisors. Do you think that's a fair reaction to have them blacklisted, and not just them, but also their villages?
This has always been a position of the Samoan government right from the start. Workers know the minute they leave that they know the rules when they sign up. They're meant to go to New Zealand or Australia, represent their countries and be good ambassadors. And so a lot of these workers that do these things, they actually know the risks when they do them. As for not having a criminal record for it, this is often the case. We've had cases where the event has occurred and there has been a criminal record, or they've just been caught and given a warning but never been invited to come back on the programs again. But we have had cases where, say, a team leader or a supervisor will use that power of authority to get a worker off the program just simply because there have been issues between them.
As you say, your research has shown that in some cases, some people have not necessarily legitimately been found guilty of doing the wrong thing. How can we be sure in this case that it isn't a situation of power play, etc., between certain individuals?
Unfortunately, as I said, it does occur that sometimes the workers haven't done what they've been accused of, and I've only come across a couple of those ones before. And so when the reports are given to the labour sending units on a worker, I think I had a case where a worker actually went to the labour sending unit to say, you know, can you please tell me what was my offence? And they wouldn't provide any information. So I think workers should also have the rights to discuss any of these reports made against them with the labour sending units, with the mediator if appropriate, and try to get down to the bottom of, you know, how are we going to base this on evidence, or are we just going to base this on this is hearsay because I'm not getting on with the team leader? So these are things that governments and the labour sending units have to deal with. But I think for me, the main issue with blacklisting that we've been finding recently is being blacklisted from maybe New Zealand and then trying to come through to Australia, or even those workers that aren't working well, that don't get reported, and they just move around from employer to employer, making it someone else's problem.
Interesting that you mentioned your research has found that some people have been blacklisted perhaps in New Zealand but making their way to Australia. Is that something that Australian officials and New Zealand officials need to be looking at? Are they looking at?
They are looking at, yes.
And does there need to be some sort of list of people who've been blacklisted that is available to immigration or labour officials in each country?
As I've said to both governments, you know, strengthening the application process for these schemes is paramount, you know, for the labour sending units. But sometimes there's a fine line between them being blacklisted and put down on a stand down. And quite often, if they're not reported on by either their employers or supervisors in either country, then the worker can go back to Vanuatu, for example, or Tonga, and say, I want to try a different scheme, but not give the issue. So I argued for some kind of database on blacklisted workers between New Zealand and Australia so they could share this data on who has been coming, who has been excluded from a particular country and for what reasons. So then the problem isn't just transferring from one country to another and one employer to another.
That is Rochelle Bailey. She's a labour migration expert at the Australian National University. Well, in an attempt to raise money to fund his legal fight against Rugby Australia, the former Wallaby, Israel Folau, is also raising a lot of questions about free speech and also freedom of religion, and also now the role of private companies in this whole debate. This comes as a new fundraising campaign, which has been started by the Australian Christian Lobby, continues to find support among many. It's now amassed over $1.5 million Australian dollars in just 24 hours since it was set up yesterday. The new campaign was started after the other online fundraising platform, GoFundMe, cancelled Israel Folau's original fundraiser that it was hosting on its website, or being set up on its website. Our reporter Priyanka Srinivasan is looking at this story for us. Priyanka, what are some of the ethical concerns people are raising now when it comes to this decision by the company, the website GoFundMe, to shut down Israel Folau's fundraiser?
Yeah, well, one concern people have voiced was the timing of it all. You'll remember Israel Folau's fundraising campaign was aiming to raise 3 million Australian dollars to help pay for his legal team. Now, this was for an unfair dismissal case that Folau is pursuing after Rugby Australia ended his contract following controversial social media posts, including one where he warned that gay people, among a list of others, including drunks and atheists, would go to hell. Now, the GoFundMe page was taken down on Monday, but it was up for long enough over the weekend to raise $700,000 and also to attract considerable debate from the public. And the length of time that it was up has raised concerns for ethicist and moral philosopher Dr. Matthew Beard, who has called into question the power of companies like GoFundMe to control what is acceptable speech in the public sphere. Here he is raising some of those concerns.
Technology companies at large are playing an increasingly significant role in the public sphere, in the kind of conversations that we are able to have, but they don't necessarily have the same coherent standards around what is acceptable or permissible speech. They can be somewhat ad hoc, and they haven't necessarily fleshed these things out or thought them through, but they're having really profound implications for the way we as a society kind of work through problems and the kinds of people who are and are not able to address that. And it always comes back to the question of, in one case, you'll be happy when someone's been removed from one of these platforms, but the possibility exists that if the circumstances are different, it will be someone who you think deserves to be able to speak who might find themselves in the same situation.
That's the ethicist Matthew Beard there. Now, Priyanka, stepping back to Rugby Australia's actual decision where it sacked Israel Folau, it is being challenged on religious freedom grounds, though Rugby Australia said that it's simply a question of an employee breaching their contract. Is there a larger debate to be had about this?
Yeah, this incident has really sparked debate, and not just here in Australia, but we certainly know in places like New Zealand and the Pacific as well. It's around religious freedom versus the ability for prominent athletes, celebrities, employees in general, really, to say things like, as Folau posted, that gay people will go to hell. In fact, an Australian government MP, Dan Tehan, has said the case highlights the need for a religious discrimination act in Australia.
Because what isn't clear at the moment is how we define the boundaries about what is what we should be free to say and what we shouldn't, especially when it comes to our religious faith. We have it for sexual discrimination, we have it when it comes to disability, we have it when it comes to age, but we don't have anything which defines the boundaries in Australia properly when it comes to religious discrimination.
So that's Australian Government MP Dan Tehan there. Now, as you mentioned, Rugby Australia has said that this is not a religious freedom question, but simply a question of a breached employee contract. But Folau is, of course, taking that decision to the courts, saying that he has no right to be sacked. Gillian Triggs is former president of the Australian Human Rights Commission and a specialist in public international law. She had this to say about that case.
Well, a legal case is going to be, I think, has to be understood in two different boxes. One is the argument that Rugby Australia is going to say, and that is that there's a clear contract. He signed the contract. He knew the terms and conditions of the contract. And that included not making remarks of this kind under the code of conduct. The question is going to be, does that place a burden on his right to freedom of speech and freedom of religious expression in a way that's disproportionate and unnecessary. Now, that second question, that second box, is going to be the one that the courts ultimately, I think, are going to have to look at.
That is Gillian Trigg. She's the former president of Australia's Human Rights Commissioner, and our reporter there was Priyanka Srinivasan. Now, we know here at Pacific Beach that this story is of real interest to many of our listeners in the Pacific, and on our Facebook page, that's ABC Radio Australia, we have just shared an analysis piece on this very issue. So if you're interested, head to our Facebook page, that's ABC Radio Australia, to take a look, have a read. Otherwise, that's it for Pacific Beach. I'm Catherine Grau. Thanks for listening.